This is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. I am Chris Ryan with Paul Steinhauser. This is the show that is all about New Hampshire politics, and we have a great show planned for you here this week. On Background, brought to you by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. They represent the Granite State's long-term care facilities. Their mission is to see the state honor and support those who care for our most vulnerable citizens. The big topic in politics and on the campaign trails, we do this show here on Thursday, is the Mueller report, which was given to Congress. It was lightly redacted. The Attorney General, William Barr, addressed the press and the nation prior to this report getting pushed forth, and once again pushed forth his notion that there was no collusion and no obstruction of justice. But as individuals, particularly Democratic presidential candidates, have read this report, there is a feeling that the special counsel did, in fact, make a strong case for obstruction of justice, but perhaps it did not fall into the purview of the Department of Justice to charge the president with obstruction of justice, and that was, in fact, more in the purview of Congress. And we bring in now Paul Steinhauser. Your thoughts on the Mueller report and what folks were saying about it on the campaign trail on Thursday?
Yeah, I'll stick with the politics there, the Democratic politics. And, you know, a lot of Democrats, not just the 2020 contenders, but they're all pointing fingers now at the Attorney General, William Barr, and saying basically he was doing a lot of heavy lifting for Donald Trump. A, by having that news conference an hour and a half before the release of the redacted version of the report. They were saying he was basically trying to spin the report in Donald Trump's favor. Take a listen to this. This is Beto O'Rourke here in New Hampshire before the report came out, but after the news conference. And he had some issues with what William Barr was doing.
The Attorney General has summarized the report in his own words. I'm not believing that summary. I'm going to believe I'm going to wait until I have a chance to read the report. I understand that the Attorney General might be sharing information about the report with the White House, which deeply concerns me. If there is any coordination, if there is any attempt to punish those who were investigating the single largest invasion of our democracy, which took place in 2016 by a foreign power, that really concerns me. But I want to make sure that I have a chance to read the report first.
Now, take that a step further. Another presidential contender in the state today, Chris, that is Eric Swalwell, the congressman from California, who's on the House Intelligence Committee. And he went a step further when it came to William Barr, calling for him to resign. Here's what he told us.
The Attorney General can represent the United States, or he can be Donald Trump's defense attorney. He can't be both. And as we saw at this press conference today, the way that he mischaracterized the Mueller report, he is seeking to help Donald Trump. He should resign. We need an attorney general who has credibility with the American people. But more importantly, this report lays out glaring vulnerabilities in our democracy. The fact that so many Russians were able to get so close to a campaign, a transition, and an administration shows that, one, we need to protect ourselves in this upcoming election. Two, we probably need to write laws to make sure no campaign in the future ever is able to do that. But three, that we need an attorney general who understands that risk and a president who can lead on that. And so I believe the attorney general should resign and that it's now Congress's job to hold the president responsible and investigate this Mueller report and hear first from Mueller.
Eric Swalwell right there. And Swalwell, of course, as you referenced, sits on that committee and has been one of the more stronger voices in the condemnation of Donald Trump in Congress. And the question now for Congress moving forward is, what are they going to do? What are Democrats in the House going to do?
Well, one thing Swalwell told me and other Democrats are saying as well is we want Mueller to testify ASAP. And that's what you're hearing a lot of the senators who are running for president as well, like Gillibrand, like Harris, like Warren, like Booker, Klobuchar. They're all asking for Mueller to testify as soon as possible. And you know, when he gets up on the Hill, those calls for maybe impeachment will be getting louder and louder with the thought that there was obstruction of justice.
Indeed. So this is a story that is not certainly not ended by the Mueller report being made public and being issued to Congress. It's a story that's going to continue to be even more significant moving forward. And before we move into our guest today, and we're going to sit down with Beto O'Rourke, also hear from Elizabeth Warren, Bill Weld, Tim Ryan, Cory Booker, and John Delaney. Yes, all of them on the show here today. Before we get into that, what do you see as being the shadow this casts on the presidential nominating contest, the potential impeachment of Donald Trump. Do you think that that's going to have any effect at all on the Democratic presidential nominating contest and the Republican side as well? We talked to Bill Weld a little bit. Republicans like John Kasich, as well as Larry Hogan, who's scheduled to be in New Hampshire next week, those folks, were perhaps waiting on something significant from Mueller.
This is going to cast a huge shadow on the Democratic presidential nomination, as well as what happens on the Republican side. Listen, this is going to be the issue that reporters are going to want to talk to the candidates about. And voters, I think, after a while may start picking up on this as well, especially if we see the drama unfold on Capitol Hill and there start to be calls by progressive Democrats on the Hill for the impeachment of the president. Now, is this a good thing or bad thing for the Democrats? That's the big question. They won in 2018, not because of this issue, not at all. They won because of health care and a couple of other issues. And a lot of Democrats feel that that's where the emphasis, that's where the spotlight should be going forward. If that spotlight is shifted to this, there's a concern that a lot of those moderates and independents in the middle may be turned off by all of this. And that is a big problem going forward.
This is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. I am Chris Reinl, Paul Steinhauser. When we return, our conversation from Gibson's in Concord with Beto O'Rourke.
Welcome back to On Background, the show that's all about the first in the nation presidential primary, brought to you by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. Beto O'Rourke making his second trip to New Hampshire since launching his presidential campaign about 5-6 weeks ago, and he had a jam-packed two-day swing. We had a chance to chat with him at his second stop in New Hampshire, his second public stop. That was at Gibson's bookstore. Chris and I talked to him about a host of issues, including whether his campaign has lost its momentum. Take a listen.
Joined by Beto O'Rourke here in Concord at Gibson's. He makes his second stop here in New Hampshire and in Concord as well. And I'm curious as to your assessment as to where your campaign is at this point in time. Huge amount of attention coming into things. What is your sense of where you are in this race?
I feel really good. We were just sharing earlier today that I believe we visited more cities, held more town halls, answered more questions. I think just under 600 questions answered at events just like we did at this one. So I'm getting a very strong sense of what's important to people, both in the questions asked about healthcare, about funding for public education, about the environment, about a woman's right to make her own decisions about her own body. But then in the one-on-one question, someone came up and said, look, I really want to make sure that under your administration, the EPA does something about the PFAS that's in our water here in New Hampshire. I had a chance to meet with Senator Sherman earlier today, who gave me a great lesson on the consequences of firefighting foam and the nonstick chemicals put on pots and pans that is now in our water system right now, and that we need real federal help and assistance and support to get that done. Wouldn't have known that if I hadn't shown up in New Hampshire. I think that makes me a better candidate, and I know it will make me a better servant in an administration that will focus on the challenges and the opportunities here in New Hampshire.
Huge amount of attention early on when you got into the race. It seems like attention has waned a little bit, as it does during the course of a campaign. How do you get to the point where you're consistently amongst, Biden and Bernie in the polls? And what's the strategy for doing that?
I just am not concerned about, nor am I following the polls. You may know that throughout the Senate campaign, we never hired a pollster or participated in a focus group or tested anything that I said or anywhere that I went. So as long as I get the chance to do this at Gibson's Bookstore, answer questions, be with people, connect eyeball to eyeball, I'm good. And I feel like I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing, which is not just introducing myself, showing up with the courage of my convictions, but listening and learning from those whom I hope to serve. So I feel really good about things. And we're still, roughly 10 months out from the first votes being cast. And that's a lot of time, a lot of miles, a lot of hours, a lot of town halls, a lot of questions. And I'm up for it, and I'm looking forward to it.
You raised a good amount of money in that first 18 days of your campaign, $9.4 million, most of it for the general, for the primary. A, can you keep that pace up in the second quarter? And B, now that you have a good amount of money, how are you going to be spending it? Staffing up in the early states? What else?
Yeah, some really good signs. Every dime we raised came from human beings. no PACs, no special interests, no corporations, and we also are not accepting money from lobbyists. Most of that money came from first-time donors. So though we raised more than any Senate campaign in United States history last year and in 2017, most of the donors had not given to that campaign. 98% of them gave under $200, and 99% of it came online. That bodes well because it means that there are more people who have given to us before who can give for the first time in this race or who can give additional amounts. So I think that speaks to our ability for capacity and pace. And then we will use that money doing just what we're doing here, ensuring that we have the ability to show up everywhere in every part of every state that we go to listen to those that we want to serve and represent, to also hire the organizers who make the most out of volunteer effort in New Hampshire, in the other states in which we're going to be competing, and connecting me with the voters that I want to serve.
I want to ask you a little about the passion that drives you, because that's one thing that I've seen consistently from you, both from afar in Texas during the Senate campaign and here in New Hampshire as well. You run the type of campaign that we see consistently do well, whether it was Kasich or John McCain in the past, where you have a tireless campaign schedule. What drives that passion, and what drives you to be out there with the energy and ferocity?
We get one shot to do this. And not just to run, but to serve this country and to confront and overcome these challenges. And we mentioned healthcare, education, immigration, perhaps the greatest of them all, climate. There are literally just 10 years left to us. If we don't get this right now, then forever after and for every generation that follows, we will have failed. So that intensity comes from that urgency. And knowing that I've got three kids at home, 12, 10, and 8 years old, we're sacrificing time together so that we can all do something for our country. Same kind of sacrifice that I see all over this state, people stepping up and serving in their way as well. So we're going to give it everything that we've got, because nothing short of the future of this country is at stake. And I think it requires everything from all of us. And I'm going to do my part.
Chris and I both have young kids, so we hear where you're coming from on that. This race probably going to change in the next couple of days. We're going to see Vice President Joe Biden. I think it's a pretty sure bet he'll be jumping in. How will that impact your campaign? And is he too old to run? Do you think he's too old to run?
You know what? I think that Vice President Biden has already demonstrated extraordinary public service to this country. I think he would be a great addition to an already outstanding field of Democratic contenders. He certainly brings something to the conversation, to the debates. I think our party, this country, which boasts the world's greatest democracy, has room enough for all these different ideas and people, lives lived and experiences brought to the table. So I think it'll be great for him to be in the race. And, here's how I come down on this. At the end of the day, by the end of next summer, we're all going to be behind the same nominee. And whoever she or he is, we're going to ensure that they can defeat Donald Trump, that they can bring this country together, and that they can be up to the challenge of this moment.
You talk a lot about policy, but one of the criticisms has been that there's not necessarily enough depth in regards to the policy. And I have a question in regards to that.
Yeah.
You have significant things that you want to accomplish, particularly in regards to climate change, where you talk about the urgency of that, universal pre-K.
Yeah.
How do you prioritize and how do you achieve these legislative priorities with a Senate and House that may be mixed with Republicans? And do you feel the need to have basically a list of a couple of things that you want to accomplish and need to accomplish early on?
So I think we can do everything that we need to do, whether that's ensuring that everyone can see a doctor, whether that's bringing these dreamers out of the shadows and making them U.S. citizens, whether it's universal pre-K or free community college, or confronting the challenge of climate change. This, the wealthiest and most powerful country on the face of the planet, has the capacity, has the resources. We just need to determine whether we have the political will. You could roll back the worst of the $2 trillion Trump tax cuts. You could end wars that have racked up trillions of dollars in debt. You could make investments in infrastructure, in drinking water, in education, and healthcare that will pay dividends. In other words, a return far greater than the initial investment, if only we can come together. And as I tried to lay out in my opening here at Gibson's today, when we passed an expansion of mental health care access for veterans, it was expensive, but we were able to get a unanimous vote out of Congress, 435-0 in the House, to do this because we worked on a bipartisan basis to our common goals and from the best traditions of this country. I think we can do that for any challenge before us going forward.
Would a climate change bill be first for you, though?
I think confronting climate, given the fact that we only have 10 years within which to act, is paramount. So, you know, day one, ensure that we're signed back up to the Paris Climate Agreements. Let's reinstitute the Clean Power Plan. Let's raise vehicle emission standards. Let's ensure that if it's the production tax credit or some other means to encourage investment in solar and wind, we do that. And then diplomatically, we've got to convene the other powers of this planet because China's got four times the coal-fired plants that we do here in the United States. We're going to have to compel or convince other countries to do their part alongside with us, but it's got to start here in the U.S. And so, yes, that's paramount.
Beto, thanks so much. Appreciate your time.
Thank you. Thanks for having us out. Appreciate it.
Former Texas Congressman Beto O'Rourke right there with Chris and I at Gibson's Bookstore. Now, a couple days ago, Elizabeth Warren was back in New Hampshire. She's here, Chris, every week. She basically comes to the state every week. It's a must-win state for her. Remember, she came out of the gate strong at the beginning of the year, and she was considered one of the top contenders for the Democratic nomination. She's lost a little bit of her luster. She's putting out a ton of policy proposals. She's, she's has good events, good-sized crowds. But I asked her recently in Durham whether she felt that maybe she had some issues with her campaign. Take a listen.
You are doing everything right in some ways. You're putting out policy proposal after policy proposal, big crowds on the campaign trail, lots of visits. But you're not popping in the polls. And I'm wondering, I know it's early, but is that concerning at all?
Look, it's early, and I'm running the campaign that I want to run. I love this. It's a chance to get out and talk to people about what's broken, about the optimism of we can fix it, and about how we're going to build a grassroots movement to do it. There's no place I'd rather be today.
So you're on course. This is
That is Elizabeth Warren with Paul Steinhauser. When we return, Paul's conversation with Bill Weld, who made it official this week. He is, in fact, primary challenging President Trump. Back with more on Background, presented by the Hampshire Healthcare Association.
Welcome back to On Background, the program that's all about the First in a Nation presidential primary, brought to you by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. Bill Weld did what we all knew he was going to do, Chris. He's been talking about launching a primary challenge against President Trump for months now. He formally did it this week, formally announced it. And what did he do? He came straight to New Hampshire, of course, a couple of days of campaigning, including some retail stops at some of the most famous diners in the state, including the Red Arrow in downtown Manchester. And I caught him up with him at the airport diner, another must-stop for White House hopefuls. Take a listen.
Strategy going forward. New Hampshire, most of your time?
I wouldn't say most, but certainly an area of emphasis because the First in the Nation primary packs such a wallop and influences other states immediately, you know, the day after the election results. So certainly, I'm not going to be a stranger. I'll probably be here part of every week between now and next February.
And is your plan to go after the independents more than Republicans?
No, my plan is to try to enlarge the electorate and persuade people that as many people as possible should vote. And that would include millennials and Gen Xers who didn't vote in large numbers last time. Less than half of millennials voted in the last election. And you got that figure up to 75%. That would be a different result than a canvas without those millennials. I thought about things like mobile voting. Don't laugh. It's you get your vote with your cell phone, but you have to have security measures like your passport is on file or your driver's license, and you take a selfie to prove you voted on the day when you say you voted. But that would, I'm sure there are some Republicans who wouldn't like that because they don't want to go out of their way to make it as easy as possible for as many people as possible to vote. But I like that because I think if we want to do this at a national level and have more participation and have people thinking for themselves. And, you know, if non-traditional voters get in and vote, they'll be thinking for themselves by definition.
Where else do you think your message can resonate? What other parts of the country do you think your message...
Oh, the West. The West is very friendly. It's West and Northwest, California. Mr. Trump is not at all well-liked in California. That's a big harvest of votes in the primary, and they moved their primary to go from June until right in the early part of the pack. Intermountain West, they don't quite have "live free or die" as their motto, but those wide open spaces, in my opinion, they think like New Hampshireites.
You're the state party chair here, Steve Stepanak. I spoke to him earlier today. He was a big supporter of Donald Trump last time around. Do you think you're going to get a fair shake from the Republicans here?
Well, no, the state party is dead set against me, and they're taking orders from Washington. And Stepanak tried to abolish the First in the Nation primary on orders from Washington, but that motion almost failed for want of a second because the cool heads noted that that might prove loyalty to Mr. Trump, but it wouldn't be very smart because then New Hampshire wouldn't have the oomph that comes from having the First in the Nation primary. So not everybody gets what they want, even chairman of state Republican parties.
But you think, even though the apparatus is dead set against you, as you say, do you think the regular Republican voters may...
No. I mean, I don't... Oh, thank you so much. I don't know how big that apparatus is. Democrats seem to be resurgent in this state recently. But we'll play it as it lays and see whether we can... have a result that isn't foreordained by a couple of party bosses.
Donald Trump raised $30 million in the first 3 months of this year, unprecedented. No, we've never seen a president earn that much this early in a cycle. How do you stay competitive? How do you match that?
My calls have been going well. I've been making some finance calls. Calling some people who are supporters of Mitt Romney, people who are supporters of Jeb Bush, and they're supportive. I don't think that New Hampshire is a primary you can buy. Anybody who came in here and said, I'm just going to buy every vote, that would not go down well here. Nationwide, it's a little bit of a different story. You got to have money to fly everybody around. You know, that could be $20 million right there. But not in this state, particularly not where I could be in New Hampshire all day, every day, and still sleep in my own bed in Canton, Massachusetts, every night.
Do you think, honestly, you can beat... Is this more of a protest vote to try to weaken the president? Or is this... You think you can beat him?
Yeah, I do. And, well, I'll tell you something else. I think I can do a better job than he can. I can cut spending. I have the political will to do it. I did that in Massachusetts. Wall Street Journal said I was the most fiscally conservative governor in the United States. That's a good start. Mr. Trump, whatever his other virtues might be, he is not an economic conservative. And I associate the Republican Party with economic conservatism. So that'd be one thing. I wouldn't turn my back on climate change and global warming the way Mr. Trump has. He gets a lot of credit for deregulation. If you look at the regulations he's rolled back, they're largely regulations to protect clean air and clean water, which again was inaugurated by Republican presidents. Richard Nixon, the EPA, Teddy Roosevelt, the National Park System, Abraham Lincoln. So the Republican Party should not put its head in the sand on climate change. And I think it would be very bad also for New Hampshire. As I say, we've already lost the old man of the mountain, and we're going to lose the snow on the White Mountains when that polar ice cap melts.
But again, when it comes back to this primary challenge, this isn't just to try to weaken him. This is to try to beat him.
No. Listen, when I ran for governor in Massachusetts, I was less than an asterisk. And you know, I went out to every event all summer long and into the fall, and sometimes all by myself. Matter of fact, often all by myself. Little by little, people said, hey, this kid keeps showing up. The same thing would be my plan here. It would be sufficient number of house parties so people would get to see me, maybe even at more than one house party. And I'm not talking fundraisers. I'm talking just say hello in a fairly intimate setting. That's the plan. And John McCain made that work here twice. Not once, but twice. And he was the underdog both times.
True enough. True enough. Have you had a chance to talk to John Kasich or Larry Hogan, either of them?
Yeah, I spoke to both of them in the last few days. Very pleasant conversations. And, you know, no sense of, hey, you're stepping in front of us at all. Just, we're proud of what you're doing. We're not saying what we're going to do. Governor Kasich and I have been friends for a long time. In fact, I've endorsed him for president twice.
If he jumps in later in the fall, what would you do?
I wouldn't get out. You know, I'd compete, but it would be an honorable competition. It wouldn't be no holds barred, knives, fangs, that sort of thing at all. Governor Kasich and Governor Hogan and I have, I think, similar approaches to government, and so it would be just as I think myself getting into the race could be even good for President Trump in sharpening him up a little bit, so that he didn't get to take everything for granted. It could be that if Governor Kasich, Governor Hogan got in, that we'd have a three-way discussion. Might be harder for President Trump to duck debates if there were three other candidates. But, you know, he certainly didn't duck debates when there were 12 or 13 of them last time.
Governor, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Also here in New Hampshire in recent days, somebody who has not been a stranger, but who was making his first trip to the Granite State as a declared presidential candidate. I'm talking about Tim Ryan, the congressman from Northeast Ohio, who went to law school right here in Concord. It used to be called the Franklin Pierce Law School. That's when he was there. Now it is UNH 3, 2, and 1. Now it's UNH Law. I had a chance to sit down with the congressman at St. A's at the New Hampshire Institute of Politics and asked him about his long shot bid for the White House.
You're getting in late compared to a lot of the others.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, the first debate's coming up pretty soon, you know, late June. Is there a concern for you about getting on that debate stage?
We're going to work real hard to try to get on it. I don't know. I mean, it's hard to tell, you know, 1% on 3 national polls, you know, the online piece of 65,000 donors. I think we're going to get on that stage. I'm pretty confident we will, but we'll see. We got 2 months. And we're out kicking it, on TV, in Iowa, here in New Hampshire again, and we're just going to keep going.
You know the state real well. You went to law school here. You made some good friends, including the state Senate President, Donna Susie.
Yeah.
You've been here a lot.
Yeah.
Do you think your years here in law school and your knowledge of the state gives you an advantage or a hand up, a leg up in this state?
I do think I have some better understanding because I live here. I mean, it's like your second home. You go to law school somewhere outside of your state, that's really the first place you really spend time. I think so. I think there's a lot of correlations, loss of manufacturing, you know, the middle class squeeze, healthcare, pharmaceuticals, really the issue around opiates. Same issue we're dealing with in Ohio. So I think we've got some significant issues that I'm trying and have worked really hard to get technology jobs. When you look at the southern part of the state, some of the successes they have, I think I can connect with the new economy initiatives that we're going to be pushing. So I'm excited to get back up here as a candidate, not as someone just kind of poking around where I used to go to law school. And I'm looking forward to it.
Some of your rivals for the nomination, when you announced, you talked on The View, and I watched it and reported on it. You emphasized you come from the heartland.
Yeah.
You know the area. You can beat Donald Trump in the states he won the White House with in 2016. You said you could put him back in Mar-a-Lago. Are you concerned that some of the rivals for the nomination can't win in the Midwest?
Well, we're going to find out. I think a lot of it's going to happen. I mean, obviously, you know, being from Ohio, we are going to win Ohio. We're in Western PA is critical to winning Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, Iowa, very culturally similar to Ohio. So I think we can make that happen. A lot of it's going to come down to message. You know, are you talking about the jobs, the wages, the health care, the pensions, the bread and butter issues of moving us from the old economy to the new economy? Can you convincingly pitch that to people, then you're going to have a shot in the Midwest.
Are you concerned that, you know, you've always said you can speak the language of the heartland. Are you concerned that maybe a Bernie Sanders or somebody else from not from the heartland can't speak that language and maybe couldn't carry those states in the general?
Well, to be determined. I mean, that's the race. Mm-hmm. I mean, you have 12 months to convince people whether you can or can't. I've not watched many of these candidates really perform on this kind of campaign level platform. So we'll see. I mean, maybe they can, maybe they can't. I mean, we got a lot of really talented people out there. It is a unique area of the country that has been left behind, and for this has been my life. This has been my family who have lost jobs starting 40 years ago when Youngstown Sheet and Tube closed to 2 weeks ago when General Motors shut down, and my family and our friends and our community felt that devastation. So this is in my bones. I'm not sure anybody knows it as well as I do or has lived this like I have. So that's an advantage politically, I guess. You know, I wish none of that did ever happen. So we'll see. I mean, you know, people rise to the occasion.
Today, as you were making the rounds and coming up here, Bernie Sanders reintroduced an updated version of his Medicare for All plan. Mm-hmm. Is that something you're on board with as well?
I've been on the Medicare for All bill since 2007. I actually think a good first step for us is to drop it to 50 or 55, help people pay for it. That would take care of a large swath of people that I represent. Steel workers, auto workers who've lost their job but can make sure they still have health care when they're 55 or 60 years old. I also think we need to let small businesses buy in, and I don't think we should be kicking people off their own health insurance if it's private. But I think this is the entirely wrong conversation. 75% of health care costs are around chronic diseases that are preventable. So we've got to have a conversation on not just what the healthcare system is to take care of people when they're sick, but how do we have a healthcare system that actually keeps people healthy?
Congressman, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Good. Congressman Tim Ryan of Ohio in New Hampshire for the first time as a declared presidential candidate. But wait, there is plenty more. We got two more Democratic contenders coming up next, Cory Booker and John Delaney, right here on Background.
This is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. I am Chris Ryan. I talked with New Jersey Senator and Democratic presidential candidate Cory Booker on the eve of the launch of his Justice for All tour in his hometown in Newark, New Jersey. Senator Booker, how are you?
I'm doing really well. It's great to be on with you.
Awesome. Appreciate you joining us for the show. Let's start off with just talking about the campaign as a whole, the campaign here in New Hampshire. The crowds have been great. The energy has been great. The anecdotal evidence is that your campaign is doing well, but polling and funding shows you lagging behind some of the field at this point. What are your feelings on the campaign as an upshot?
Well, I'm excited. I mean, the energy we're getting, as you said, the crowds, the energy. Obviously, we have some folks with better name recognition right now, but we are completely confident in the way this is going in the early months of the campaign, and we are building. And we're campaigning, you know, the right way. We're going out directly to voters from town halls to living rooms. I'm going to earn every single vote, and I'm just excited about the opportunity to do that, and that folks are greeting me with such enthusiasm.
You got the first endorsement of any state senator here in the Granite State as well, and Senator Morgan is actually driving down with Jim Demers to see your campaign announcement tomorrow in regards to your Justice for All tour in your hometown of Newark, New Jersey. And this is a really intriguing concept to me because it combines economic justice, social justice. What is the messaging behind this?
Well, I think every American, you know, we all want a fair shot. And we know that if we're not giving, you know, big tax breaks to corporations, but investing in our schools and healthcare, investing in our infrastructure, apprenticeship program, that we could have economic justice, that we could have justice in healthcare. And if we have a criminal justice system that, you know, we're 5% of the globe's population, but we're locking up one out of every four incarcerated people on the planet Earth. Dear God, if we can have a system that empowers people to succeed, that we could really be a nation that thrives again for everyone, not just a fortunate few. So I'm excited. The message is resonating, and really the method is resonating. I'm going to talk tomorrow very openly about love being the most toughest, most durable force there is, and that we can't win this election by fighting on Donald Trump's turf and his terrain, not by showing the worst of who we are. We've got to actually show the best of who we are in this campaign and begin to appeal again to Americans' ideals of grace, that we have to have common sacrifice and be stand for each other and be there for each other, that that's the way things improve in our country. So I'm excited to lay my case out tomorrow in this hometown kickoff, and glad that there's going to be everybody from Granite Staters there, to even my mom flew in from Las Vegas.
That's cool. And I'm interested, you know, in your focus, particularly in regards to economic justice. We've seen, obviously, a lot of attention over the last really number of decades focused on urban communities. And now, in this last election, we are hearing more about difficulties in regards to economics in suburban communities, the Springsteen voters, if you will, folks who have seen their communities change as a result of jobs leaving. What are your plans in regards to bringing economic justice for both the urban, which has been focused upon, and perhaps there needs to be changes there, and the suburban, which has not been focused upon as much?
Yeah, and I would include in that not focusing enough on rural areas.
Right.
And this has to go with a lot of the basics that we stopped investing in, and whether that's public education, and which is always a pathway to career success, but yet we're underfunding our schools. Teachers' pay is too low, and our schools are doing more and trying to do it with less. And that's why, as President of the United States, we're going to fully fund special needs education, fund apprenticeship programs for our young people, because everybody doesn't go to college. But for those who do, we're going to make college affordable again to cut down on that debt. We're also going to make sure that small businesses don't get a fair shake in this country. You know, we turned Newark around by opening up hundreds and hundreds of businesses, entrepreneurs getting access to capital and having a chance to compete. Well, we don't see that in our suburban areas, in our rural areas, who are often denied access to capital. We've got to make sure that we are a country that's about building our economy from the grassroots up, from small businesses to giving people who are working labor, dignity again, making sure that we have jobs that pay a living wage and that people get the skills and the training they need to get jobs in the 21st century.
In conclusion, as you referenced, you're going to talk about love in the speech tomorrow, and you talk about that a lot on the campaign trail, and there is an overtly positive nature to who you are, and it just exudes during your remarks. But, you know, we are a cynical people as a whole, and perhaps more so here in the great state of New Hampshire, maybe not so, more so than New Jersey. But there's that feeling of, oh, yes, I mean, there's positivity and we need to move forward. But there's also that cynicism that Donald Trump was the last individual elected president of the United States. And perhaps things are amiss in our country and there needs to be more anger mixed in with the love. What do you say to that?
Well, I have to say, I think anger is understandable and justified. I'm angry. And, you know, but we come from a country at our best that we do not succeed when we tear each other apart or try to tear each other down. That's Donald Trump's way. We don't emulate the very thing that we're against. We need to take this not to the gutter, but we need to go to higher ground as a country. Look, our best chapters of American history are like that. You had guys like Bull Connor with dogs and hoses. How did we beat him? Well, not by bringing bigger dogs and bigger hoses. We beat him by actually raising the moral imagination of this country. Black folks and white folks from New Hampshire and New Jersey, joining folks in Birmingham to eventually end segregation and take down that bully. And so I believe this is a time we need a revival of civic grace. We need more empathy for each other. And in fact, the only way to beat Donald Trump is not try to beat him on his turf, but to change the game and raise the level of our fight, not by the worst of who we are, but by showing the best of who we are.
As Senator Booker, as always, appreciate joining us for the program. Look forward to seeing you again here soon in the great state of New Hampshire.
Thank you very much. All my best to everyone up there. I'll be up there again soon. Thank you.
That is Cory Booker. John Delaney was in the Granite State as well this past week, the former congressman from Maryland. I want us to get your sense of what folks are most interested in. You know, as you talk with folks at the coffee shops, at the breakfasts, at the town hall meetings, and obviously it varies from audience to audience, but is there a particular theme that you are sensing from individuals that come to your events?
Yeah, I would say the overarching theme is how frustrated people are with politics. And they feel like nothing gets done, and you know, most elected officials just spending all their time fighting with each other and not engaging in what I call the politics of progress, which is actually rolling up your sleeves and finding common ground and getting things done and trying to improve people's lives. They're very frustrated by that. You know, a lot of Democratic primary voters are obviously almost have a singular focus on beating Trump as their number one criteria for this election coming up. But in terms of a theme that I think unifies Democrats, Republicans, Independents, is just the dysfunctional nature of the federal government and how we don't have leaders who actually try to find common ground and get things done.
Why do you feel that that is? Because obviously, in election after election, that is a dominating theme. And the individual that gets the vote and support of the New Hampshire voter is generally one that pledges to change that environment, to change that culture. And, you know, anecdotally speaking, it seems like things are kind of getting worse, and that there's a benefit to inaction and finger pointing, and both a financial and a re-election benefit to that.
Yeah, I think unfortunately, Chris, we've got some bad incentives right now, which is that if you're a candidate and you run on division, you tend to excite a lot of interest in social media and the Twitter world and that kind of stuff. And if you're running on problem solving and solutions, while most of the American people are interested in that, you know, it's not, that doesn't sell quite as well with the activists on either side of the aisle. So I think, you know, I think basically what has to happen is the center's got to take the country back. You know, for too long this country has been held hostage by the extremes in each party, and I just think it's got to stop.
I've been thinking about over the last couple of days a conversation I had with John Kasich that was off air, but was one that I think is significant in this moment, in that, you know, during the primary, individuals were engaging with Donald Trump, and that was kind of a way to draw attention. And he, you know, said continuously that, I can't do that. That's not who I am, and I want to run the campaign that I'm going to run, and if I'm going to lose as a result of that, I'm going to lose. I'm going to be happy with, you know, the campaign that I ran. And, you know, he's like, if you want red meat, I could throw red meat out there, but I have a conscience. And, you know, just making claims and saying things in order to get attention and just to say those things and know that I can't actually deliver on them and to make promises and to highlight division, it was just not something that I'm comfortable doing. And I'm curious from your standpoint, as an individual that is investing a significant amount of your own capital, has been at this for a long period of time. I mean, is there a frustration in that you're trying to run the campaign that you want to run, but you look at the media environment and you see how it works, and you're like, okay, if I just did this, or if I focused on this, then I'm going to be moving away from my core values, but this is what I need to do in order to generate more attention?
Well, I wouldn't say it's a frustration. To the extent I have a frustration, it's with how politics has failed the American people. You know, people often ask me, okay, what gets me mad? And I'm like, well, I'll tell you what gets me mad is just how the political system has failed the American people. I mean, politics in this country used to be about a way of organizing ourselves so that we could have a battle of ideas, then ultimately find common ground, and then get a few things done.
Mm-hmm.
And instead, it's become a way it's become a platform to emphasize our division and increasingly to entertain us. And what really angers me is that a lot of people are paying the price because of this. And most significantly, you know, the next generation, my kids, your kids, everyone's children out there, are paying a huge price because the political system has failed to get the basic things done we should have done. You know, I used to say in business, the cost of doing nothing is not nothing. And we've paid a huge price as a country because we really failed to do the basic things in public education, in tax policy, in health care, you know, in climate, in a number of areas that were pretty obvious, and that there is still an opportunity to find, you know, bipartisan support for. And in many ways, you know, that's entirely what my candidacy is about, which is a bunch of new ideas that I think can get broad support and get done. And I'd be very happy to finish my term as president, having accomplished a huge number of things, and have gotten no credit for them, because all I want to do is get things done, and I don't really care who gets the credit. And I just think that's where the American people ultimately are. I have enormous faith in the American people. I think they're going to come around to this way of thinking, because they're increasingly frustrated with politics. But, you know, there is a lot of distractions right now in politics.
That is former Maryland Congressman and Democratic presidential candidate John Delaney. This is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association.